I've also got a tangent tan tan tan. Oh, I'm not even trying to say it. I've also got a tan tan chantel. Oh, no, I've completely. I was practicing the whole time you were asking me your question, Chris, and now I've forgotten how to say it. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Reed Smith.
Lovely to be here, folks.
And it's an absolute honour to have you here. And I'm looking forward to getting stuck into the role of background knowledge in reading. But first, Chris, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
Over the festive season, I purchased a book called Highly Irregular by an American author, I believe American, perhaps Canadian, certainly from North America, called Erica Oprent. As I say, it's a book called Highly Irregular. It's all about the English language, how it came to be. It is a really incredibly accessible introduction to not just etymology, but also just the broader study of the kind of fun bits about English, all of those little questions that you might have had at some point or heard at some point about the English language, why it's the oddball that we know it to be, are answered in this book in a really engaging fashion. You can read it in, you know, a couple of hours, blast through it, a perfect place to start for anyone who is interested in that kind of stuff. What about you, Reed? What are you reading for?
I'm reading a book called Leadership on the Line by Ronald Harfitz and Marty Linsky. It's a book I've been back to a couple of different times, and it's really dealing with an aspect of leadership where you want to cause some sort of change in the status quo, but you're not quite sure about how to go about it, navigate some of the emotions that sit around making changes to a situation that probably most of the people in your organisation are pretty comfortable with. And it's a book I've returned to a couple of times because I think I understand more every time I've gone back to the book. So there's been times where I thought I've understood something, something happens at work or in my personal life or somewhere else, and then I reflect on it and I think, oh, that's what they meant. So it's well worth a read. It's got great anecdotes in it that are quite interesting. So if you get a chance to read and it's something in your wheelhouse, please do so. I'd recommend it highly. So Kieran, what you reading for?
They both sound fantastic. And unlike my recommendation, they're probably going to be really useful for people. I mean, mine came from sort of Google search. You know, I send myself emails when new papers are published. And it came from Dan Rosen's episode on stress and memory, and so I've sort of got some keywords coming in, and it's called The Role of Serotonin in Fear Learning and Memory, A Systematic Review of Human Studies, and that's by Francesco Tortora. And I thought this is going to be about fear and learning in the classroom, and I was all, well, where's this going to go to? But actually it's about human conditioning and its impact on memory in terms of, if I've made this mistake, I'm not going to make it again kind of thing. They call it aversive learning. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because I think it's a good exercise in sifting through the bits that are important in a study, because there's lots of science, lots of medical science. You know, they talk about things like HP5, which I assume is the name for serotonin. But if you go through it, there might actually be something in terms of, you know, the role of arousal on actual learning. You know, we know that stress and arousal are quite closely linked. And I think this is going to be one of those papers that takes me in a different direction. But it's an exercise for those of us who are sort of interested in developing our research engagement skills. You're not going to find a more alien paper, I don't think, but has some relevance to education. This week, we're going to explore the role of background knowledge, in particular, a somewhat seminal paper that you know, I think you're the lead author on. I know that sometimes the order of the authors it depends on the role that they play, but I know that, you know, this is obviously something you've got a great depth of expertise in, but you're also sort of spearheading the, I want to say, evidence-informed, or certainly, you know, the relationship between evidence and classroom practice in Australia. And I think it makes sense to begin with, you know, a bit about who you are, Reid, your research interests, and how you came to research the role of background knowledge in reading.
Gee, that's an august introduction there, Kieran. I'm not sure I'm spearheading. I might be on one of the front pontoons, but that'd be about as far out as I'm a teacher. I've taught primary and secondary from our prep, which is 5-year-olds through to year 12s. So our school leavers age in a variety of different subjects for about 2 decades, working in a regional school here in Victoria, Australia. And it's been a wonderful experience for me during that time of developing my practice with a great group of educators. My family's teachers all the way down, so it's flowing through my blood, and despite my siblings' best efforts to avoid being teachers, we get sucked back into the profession in one way or another. So it's something that's dear to my heart, that educating kids. This particular research interest actually came from some of our experience at the school at which I worked. We pride ourselves on developing our instruction, developing our effectiveness, and then seeing students' skills and knowledge change and move as a result of the changes in our practice. But we'd been working on our reading instruction for some time. We just didn't feel like we had agency in our reading instruction like we did in other areas. We felt that we could make change in our mathematics instruction, or that we'd made some informed changes to how we taught writing, and we could see the impacts of that in our kids' work and what they knew how to do. But we didn't necessarily see that in reading, and we just felt that we didn't quite have the agency that we wanted to. We'd used leveled readers, we worked in small group instruction, forever going over the main idea and inferencing and finding the explicit and implicit information in the text. Like, we'd just been through that over and over again for years and years. And as a school, we then decided we needed something different. We couldn't continue to do what we'd always done. And it was one of the members of the staff, Greg Ashman, who was leading our teaching and learning. He'd come across the work of Don Hirsch, who'd suggested this strong link between background knowledge and reading comprehension. And we made the leap of faith into focusing more on a deliberate knowledge building strategy to underpin our work in teaching reading. And I guess my involvement started there because I felt like it was our best bet at the time, but I wanted to know a little bit more about the causal mechanisms, because it made sense from a theoretical point of view. But what I really wanted to do was to make all of those links in the chain, from Don Hirsch's argument, which sort of had some correlational information in there, but there's a lot of different factors that could impact it. And I really wanted to get through to the end and say, well, to what degree can teaching a systematic knowledge base to our kids over a long period of time impact on their ability to read a variety of different texts at the end of it? And so that started the study that I've been on for 7 or 8 years, I guess, now. This paper was one of the first parts of that paper, just checking the background information that existed at the time and gaining probably a stronger understanding of the field and what currently existed.
Just before we move on and dive into the paper a little, I'd like to say, I just think, having read this paper a number of times, I didn't know your background. I didn't know that you had been an educator yourself. I had always kind of just assumed that your background was purely kind of into research. And yet I'm not surprised by that, because it's one of the most readable, as a teacher, it's one of the most readable papers I've ever encountered in this area, despite the fact that it deals with quite complicated, nuanced subject matter and quite a lot of stuff. It is eminently readable. If there's one paper that I like nudge teachers towards, just to say, look, you might be interested in research behind reading, this is a wonderful way in, because as well as being, as I say, nuanced, complex, relevant to educators, it's also just so accessible. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me now to learn that you have this background in education. You know how to write for educators. I guess in order to explore this paper really well, worth clarifying a couple of terms. This is all about background knowledge. So in the context of reading, what precisely do you mean by background knowledge? And in particular, how does that contrast with other forms of knowledge that might support comprehension? Like we might think of the knowledge of how syntax works in a sentence or vocabulary. How does that overlap? Does it subsume those things? What is background knowledge in this context?
Yeah, really great question, because it's sort of a not a contested space, but certainly there's a variety of different opinions about what exactly is encompassed in background knowledge, because presumably, or there's an argument that it's basically everything, right? That's a form of knowledge, even skill as an application of knowledge and connections between different ideas. But in the case of this particular paper, I guess my starting point would be to say that whenever an author is putting together some piece of writing, they're always making assumptions that their reader will know something. It's really difficult to write anything, a narrative or any other text, that doesn't make any assumptions about things that you might know about the world or the way that it works or its histories. So background knowledge in this particular context, in the context of this paper, is really that information that the author is assuming that you know, and outside of what we might say is word recognition and vocabulary. So if we put aside that you know the meanings of the words that sit within the text that you're reading, the background knowledge is the other pieces of information that an author is assuming that you know, that is particularly critical to understanding the text. So because there's a wide variety of things that you could consider as being background knowledge for a particular text, because every time the author mentions something new, there's another schema that you activate from your long-term memory. However, the background knowledge that we're talking about here is just those pieces of information that the text hinges on that the author is not being explicit about. So even if I was talking about what I did when I got up this morning, the alarm went off, I had a shower, I ate breakfast, I brushed my teeth. Well, there's some assumptions the author may be making about that idea of brushing teeth that go beyond the vocabulary. And it might be that usually people brush their teeth after they eat, and it's used to clean the teeth and remove plaque. And we remove plaque because it's a causal factor in a range of different diseases, not to mention noxious breath. And that, if that piece of information, the brushing of the teeth, is important for events later on or for understanding the text, then we'd say that that background knowledge, brushing the teeth, is an important part of the text. And we'd say that's background knowledge for this particular text. So there's really a long-winded way of saying the background knowledge is that implicit information that's required to understand the text that the author hasn't spelt out and sits beyond, I guess, those aspects of how the language works. So just the pure vocabulary sense or the syntactical structures of the text itself.
And another idea that is central to this paper are what you might think of as levels of comprehension that someone can deal with. Obviously, there's kind of a literal memorization of a text that might take place, whereby I've just read a sentence, I can tell you verbatim, word for word, what that is. But there are also levels of kind of a bit more abstract than that, known as the text base and the beyond that, even a situation model. For the purposes of this episode and to support listeners in understanding, could you detail what is meant by text base and situation model in this context?
The text base really is they're the elements and the relations that are made explicit in the text. So it's how it's usually conceptualized by researchers is it's a propositional framework. So how are the elements that are sitting in the text related to one another? But it sits that only in the areas that are made explicit by the author. So you're not making inferences or making implicit judgments at this level of the text base. That text base is then incorporated with the things that you know from your long-term memory to form what's called the situation model. I guess the easiest way to think about the situation model is it's your understanding of what is going on in the text. So whether it be a narrative, persuasive, or a different kind of text, The situation model is like the gist. So your current understanding, which may be the intention of the author or maybe something completely different. So the text base is the your organization of the explicit information that's in the text. And then you've got this integration of that information with ideas that are coming from your long-term memory to form the gist or the general understanding that you personally hold about what's happening in text at that particular moment. The interesting thing is that the situation model, even for us as competent readers, is going to be different, so that when we're reading the same text, our situation model is going to be different, because even if we form a similar text base, we've got different understandings and experiences, and we've got different knowledge in our long-term memory, and our schema is more or less developed for particular ideas. So that's actually going to change the situation model we have and how rich the situation model is. So it is helpful when we're thinking about reading comprehension to think of these two levels. So the text base, which is almost just drawing out what's explicitly stated in the text, and then the situation model, which is what occurs after it's been integrated with what we know.
I mean, there's a great reason to read that serotonin paper I was talking about, because then you'll understand what it's like when you don't have a grasp of the text base or the situation model. In general terms, what are the key takeaways from this paper?
If you're going to take away two things from the paper, Kieran, the first one would be that it confirms probably what we know intuitively, that background knowledge influences our comprehension of a text. So the more that we know about a particular topic or idea that's really important for a text, the more likely we are to comprehend the text. And that's true for both less skilled and skilled readers, that background knowledge is quite helpful. So I'd say that's the first one, is just again reinforcing the idea that background knowledge is important. And probably the second one is about how the genre of the text and the cohesion of the text affects the degree to which that background knowledge is really helpful. So there's an interaction whenever we read between what we know and our skills as readers and the features of the text itself, in terms of what genre it is and then how cohesive it is. And that actually affects our ability to harness that power of the background knowledge to help compensate for our reading ability. So I think that those two elements, the impact of background knowledge and the fact that genre cohesion make a difference, are probably the two most important parts from the paper.
The part of the paper that I find particularly fascinating is where you start talking about some of the limitations of working with the kind of studies that you are accumulating and then analysing. I wonder whether you could speak to that in particular, because you're talking about background knowledge and comprehension, two things that are quite challenging to measure, I guess. So what limitations did you find in interpreting these? I think it was 30 or so studies, or 23, 24, whatever it was, studies that you ended up kind of focusing upon.
I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the difficulties, Chris. I was really surprised by the range of measures used to measure, first of all, the knowledge that a participant brings to the table, so how much they know and what the difference is between domain-specific knowledge or the greater, broader idea of world knowledge. How much do they know in general? So there were, for each of the papers, they had a different way of measuring that. So whether it be that a quiz beforehand or some associated measure, sometimes they used measures that were available on standardized assessments in terms of world knowledge. So others used more bespoke measures. So there was this range of measurements, which immediately made it difficult to compare cohorts between papers. And the same was also true for the outcome measures, that what it is that different papers and different researchers chose to measure to indicate the proficiency of the reading comprehension just varied from paper to paper. Some used a recall of events in the text. Some researchers decided that they'd use measures where the children who were part of the study would order the importance of particular events. Some would use a closed type exercise. Some would use a free recall of elements in the text. Some would answer multi-choice questions. Others would write paragraphs. So you had this incredibly broad range of assessment measures, which indicated too that there were different conceptions of what reading comprehension is and what the outcomes of a reader who comprehends a text, what that outcome would look like. So my initial ideas when I was putting together the paper of maybe synthesizing them into a meta-analysis trying to quantify things a little bit more across the papers was made really difficult because these measures weren't applicable. So that I think as somebody who came in to this research a little bit cold, I was surprised by that range. So that immediately indicated that we had a variety of different views on the inputs of reading and the outputs of reading.
And this is one of the things we find perhaps that is problematic or causes problems, at least in education, in that often these measures of reading comprehension end up being almost mistaken for comprehension itself. So, for example, you know, when a pupil can write a lengthy response to a set of questions about a text, that's a perfectly useful way perhaps to measure comprehension, but that isn't necessarily comprehension itself. Comprehension itself is, for want of a better phrase, the invisible thing that's gone on inside a reader's head.
A lot has been made, I think, and rightly so, of the importance of background knowledge in reading. Certain studies, such as Recht and Leslie's 1988 baseball study, I mean, this is certainly the first time I encountered this idea, have become touchstones for those who want to highlight the value of background knowledge. Your paper suggests that there's some nuance here, in particular relating to the way that background knowledge can compensate for weaker word recognition capabilities. Could you unpack this idea for us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Recht and Leslie paper is referred to a lot. You're right. It's the baseball study. It's the number one, the go-to study for a lot of people, and it was. It's a really nice paper that suggests that background knowledge can help compensate for generally poor reading skill, and they have accomplished that by asking children who have high or low knowledge of baseball to read a passage about events in a baseball game, and then they are asked to recall the elements of that story and to order events in the story in terms of their importance to the game. And the methodology was based on a series of studies by other researchers in the late 70s and Chiesi and Boston team that were looking into a similar idea. But the great little element that they've added is comparing that background knowledge to their starting reading comprehension and being able to measure across the two. I think that paper has been brought forward, and rightly so, as an indicator that background knowledge is really important part of our reading comprehension. However, sometimes I think it's been misinterpreted in different places, perhaps by suggesting that increased background knowledge on a topic can completely ameliorate poor reading skill. That if I have a poor reader in my class, then all I need is a diet of more background knowledge, and that will fix them as a strategy. I've also seen it being used to say that, well, once students have pretty good decoding skills, then reading comprehension really is just teaching them more stuff about the world and that's it. So almost like this idea that it's just world knowledge plus decoding, and that equals reading comprehension. And really that doesn't necessarily square with the rest of the research that came into this particular paper. So there are a couple of observations that we made when we were putting together this critical review. First of all, that the text and the content of what you're reading really matters. The outcomes from this particular study where the less skilled readers and the more skilled readers actually had similar performance on this particular task. It's been replicated, but really it's replicated in really specific situations where you have a limited field of knowledge. Typically it's in a game like soccer or baseball. It's really goal-oriented. So there's a clear, the actors within that particular story, there's a clear thing that they're trying to achieve at any particular time. So when we look at studies that move to texts of different genres or that require a wider knowledge base about the world, the level of compensation, background knowledge tends to drop off a little bit. We don't see the same effects where a stronger background knowledge means that your less skilled readers are indistinguishable from your more skilled readers. Instead, you see some effect of the background knowledge, but there's still a difference, a statistically significant difference in the understanding between more and less skilled readers. Probably I'd say that it's important to note that the level of compensation depends on how you're measuring reading comprehension. So you tend to see those really large effects of background knowledge on assessments that are looking for a student's recall of events. So really that are plumbing the text-based understanding rather than the situation model. So once you move to questions that are asking students to make inferences about the text from what they're reading, then you tend to find that those compensatory effects of background knowledge start to drop away a little bit. And I think that when we discuss this paper, we probably need to acknowledge a little bit more of some of those limitations and that hard and fast idea that it's all background knowledge once they're good decoders doesn't necessarily hold, and that genre actually matters. So you just need to have a little more variety in your instruction and think intentionally about how you apportion your instruction time, because that's a valuable thing for us as teachers.
I would say for me, probably the most interesting part of the study, and I know actually, I mean, you ask me on a different day, I'll probably pick a different bit because it is something I've read a number of times. But the most interesting part of the study for me is what you describe, I think, as a reverse cohesion effect, something that you suggest is potentially a version of the expertise reversal effect from cognitive load theory. What do we mean by the expertise reversal effect, and what is this reverse cohesion effect, and how do they kind of connect together?
Yeah, so as you say, the expertise reversal effect comes from cognitive load theory, from Sweller and his various colleagues, and really just describes situations where the relative effectiveness of learning conditions changes depending on the expertise of the learner. So often that's discussed in terms of when you have a learner who has low mastery, they are novice of a particular idea, often explicit instruction, large levels of modelling and rehearsal, a guided practice is a really useful thing for developing their expertise. However, there comes a tipping point in their expertise when that explicit instruction is no longer as effective as the learner's moving into a different mode of learning. So it might be looking at non-routine problems in order to build their understanding and see a range of different applications. What you might see is more guided inquiry type instruction. So the reversal is basically what's good for the novice learners suddenly is much less effective for those learners who are more expert. And we thought that we saw something a little bit similar with the reverse cohesion effect that was coined, I think, by Daniel McNamara in the 90s, where when we're considering the text, every text has this property that's cohesion. And cohesion is the degree to which a text is easily read, and that the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs work together in a logical sequence that's easy for a reader to follow. Right, so high cohesion texts are generally easier for readers to unpack. The less difficulties, you need to make fewer inferences as you're reading, because it's giving you cues for the relationships between different ideas. A less cohesive text is often more difficult. It's asking you to draw on your background knowledge far more often. It's got fewer signposts as to how one idea relates to the next. So the reverse cohesion effect, it's describing the ways in which learners or readers who have different levels of knowledge gain from texts of different levels of cohesion. And really the quick way to say it is, if you've got children or any reader who has a low knowledge base for a particular topic, they learn more from a high cohesion text, right? It's beneficial for them to have a text that's easier to read, where the connections are laid out for them, that they don't have to draw on their perhaps non-existent prior knowledge to be able to make sense of the text. And Kieran, you pointed to this before with your reading of the the text that you've been reading recently is the same for me with some of the work that I did as part of this study. Is you open up a book and you quickly realize after three pages that the level of cohesion is so low to my background knowledge that I just can't make any sense of it. So I need something that's more cohesive. So these low knowledge readers, they learn more from these high cohesion texts. But the interesting thing is, and where you get this reversal idea, is that for high knowledge readers, they actually learn more and benefit more from low cohesion texts. So the text understanding for those readers who have high knowledge is actually improved if you can force them or induce them to make more inferences, and those inferences are successful. So if you've got somebody who knows a lot about sharks, for example, you want them to learn more about sharks, then it's actually beneficial for them to encounter text that's a low cohesion text. They have to infer and keep drawing down their knowledge of sharks from their long-term memory to make these inferences. They're having a high success rate in those inferences, so they're able to maintain a really strong and rich and accurate understanding of the text. They're going to learn a lot more from that cognitive work that they are embarking on than perhaps if you gave them a low cohesion text where they didn't, that wasn't required for them to bring in this knowledge from their long-term memory because it's already explicit, it's spelt out in the text. So in the critical review, we talked about this Goldilocks effect where we've got to find that point for the kids in the class where the text is at a level that's effortful enough that they have to really think carefully about what it is that they're reading and draw in any of the background knowledge that they do have, but it's not so effortful that the inferences they're making are incorrect or that they can't engage with the text, or the act of reading and making sense of the text is so effortful that there's none of that cognitive space remaining for them to actually transport some of those ideas and encode it back into working memory. And I think it's a really interesting idea for us as teachers when we're thinking about the texts we choose for our students in our classes and the scaffolding support that we provide for our kids while we're reading those texts.
Alongside this idea of the expertise reversal effect, what this immediately brought to mind is the general idea of like desirable difficulties, because in effect what we're doing here, well, as far as at least this is my interpretation of it, is, you know, if a kid doesn't have a great deal of background knowledge, they need all the help they can get to make something from the text. And these cohesive devices like consequently, and as we said in the first sentence, or subheadings that say what's about to happen or what's just happened or whatever it might be, all of these cohesive ties, really helpful for them to just get any kind of sense from the text. Whereas if you've got loads of this background knowledge, you already know quite a lot about the thing that you're reading, you need something to keep you awake. You know, you need to be nudged to find this difficult in order to recall, because I presume this is being measured on, you know, through pupils' recall after the event. In order to remember what you've learned from this text, you need to be forced to reread stuff and to actually go, oh, hang on a minute, what did that say? You need to be, you can't go through it on autopilot. So yeah, I mean, I think this has wider implications for teaching reading, certainly. I love this idea of the Goldilocks zone of texts where you're saying it needs, I want them to understand it, but I don't want it to be easy. As soon as it becomes easy, they are, you know, they won't be learning from the text in the way that I want them to, particularly, as we say, if they already know some stuff about the text. So yeah, I was that is, as I said, the most fascinating part of the text for me, and the one that made me start thinking about the texts that I use. I guess one of the challenges, and I might, if I can ask you a separate question on this, is that obviously I presume a lot of this stuff is done with pupils reading text independently. And so these effects are often about, you read this text and I want to see what you can make from it. Whereas in the classroom, we're doing something slightly different, whereby we're probably, hopefully, intentionally pitching the text above where pupils can make sense of it on their own, and then using our expertise as teachers, our knowledge of the text, to, you know, to scaffold it, because, you know, that makes sense. We don't just want them reading stuff that they can make sense of purely on their own. So do you think that these findings are most applicable to us thinking about the kind of independent reading we give to kids? Or do you think there are wider things we can take away for that more scaffolded classroom instruction?
Primarily, we would apply them to students with their independent reading. Probably what I wouldn't want people to think is that for a class that I have, I need to come up with 24 versions of the same text that the students are going to read, or we're going to get into groups where I group students by their background knowledge to read particular texts. So really, my first part of the answer would be primarily for individual reading. However, it also feeds into some of that classroom instruction, because as a teacher, when we're working with a complex text, we're making judgment calls all the time about the levels of scaffolding support that we give prior to reading the text, while reading the text, and then following it up, and then how we can adjust the levels of scaffolding we provide for different students that we have in our care. And I know that some teachers have found some success in having just a slight version of texts, particularly for non-fiction texts, where they might provide some more subheadings. It might be a diagram that accompanies it for some of the students, just to sit as a scaffold and support to help them navigate the text without it being the case of having six different versions of text. So I think it does have implications for the way that we teach both the whole class level of instruction, but also in terms of the texts that we select for our kids to engage with.
I think what I love about this paper in particular is the way it orients the whoever's reading it to a kind of quite productive way to think about how we support pupils. And this links to kind of what you've just been saying there, because there's often a temptation to say, oh, okay, these are my weak readers, and so I need to do this to accommodate for them. Whereas when we start thinking about background knowledge and the impact that has, we're starting to perhaps think, oh, well, actually, I know that these pupils have certain knowledge about the contents of this text already, and so this might be more appropriate. Or actually, this text is on a subject that I know my pupils know very little about, so what I'm going to have to do is X, Y, and Z. So rather than just thinking about, you know, stronger readers or weaker readers, etc., we start to think about that interaction between the pupil and the text. It isn't just, are they capable readers or not? It's what's their capability like with reference to this specific text? And that's something I'm always banging on about, this idea of, you know, a pupil's ability to comprehend is often specific to the contents of the text rather than text more generally. So yeah, another reason to recommend this text is that it has this orientation that I mentioned.
I've also got a tangent, because as I'm listening, I'm thinking it might be about the distinction between the expertise reversal and the reverse cohesion effect. The residue that I've got from my reading about that from a long time ago is that expertise, that level of expertise, probably comes in around A-level in England. So I'm thinking 17 years old, 18 years old, when you've mastered a subject to that level, that's probably when that kind of thing helps. But with the reverse cohesion effect, I'm imagining 7 and 8 year olds. Have I misinterpreted the research? And is that possibly the distinction between the two?
Well, I guess it's the question of domain size that we're thinking about in terms of the knowledge, that you can have younger readers who have a sufficient domain knowledge to be able to make sense of a text and start to work with texts that are a little bit more complex. And you can, I think that going back to some of the things you were talking about earlier, Chris, in terms of the kids who are coming into your classroom with the high levels of knowledge around particular topics, one of the powers of having a knowledge-rich and coherent curriculum is that you can actually set things up so that you can help students develop a strong knowledge base in a particular area. Select a text a little bit further down the line that you know the kids have had the opportunity to learn about the context of that text, and so you can actually pick and select texts that are more difficult than maybe you choose if for your class when that's a little bit less known. And I think there are age limitations in terms of how complex or how low the cohesion is. So I guess that when we're talking about that effect, that curve will look a little bit different for younger students compared to older students. But I think that if we think about cohesion as the relative levels of cohesion to text that are on into particular ages of students, then I think that we'd see a reverse cohesion effect for texts that are lower cohesion for relative to the age of particular students. And you're going to find it really difficult to have students even with high levels of background knowledge to parse texts that are deliberately difficult to read. It's just a much more difficult thing for them to be able to do. You are going to be able to introduce texts that are not deliberately simple, where they start to use some fewer cohesive ties, and the kids are going to have to make more inferences. So I guess when I talk about that change in the effect, that the cohesion is age relative to some degree.
So I think, the backbone of this podcast is then, what does this mean for teachers in the classroom? What does this look like? And will it affect our practice? You make some recommendations for those working in education towards the end of the paper. Well, what would you say to teachers listening, thinking, okay, right, what's this going to mean for me in my daily life?
I think that the first one is just a consideration of the texts that you select for your classes and for groups of students relative to what you know that they know about. So I think that sometimes I'm guilty sometimes as a teacher of choosing texts that I like and then finding out halfway through reading that text that I've misjudged where my students are at. But maybe that they don't know as much as perhaps I thought they did. So thinking carefully about the text that you've chosen and maybe investigating a bit about what they know beforehand, or thinking about how, as you mentioned before, Chris, how we might be able to preload some of that background knowledge before we get started on a particular text. I recommend in the paper the importance of teaching knowledge base in schools in a coherent fashion. So a knowledge rich curriculum, that it's not just because knowing things is fantastic, but because it helps us unlock a wider variety of texts, and particularly moving to knowledge that sits outside students' direct experience. I think that it's important that that's built in a sequence of coherent way. And I think explicit instruction is one way we can do that. So building that common understanding of particular ideas, concepts, historical times, scientific concepts and theories. When you have at least some shared knowledge base that sits in the students that sit in your classroom, then it means that you can more easily select texts that are going to be relevant and accessible for them. You can push them in other ways that means that you've taken into consideration the background knowledge of your kids. So, for example, it means that you can choose texts that maybe that are a little bit more complex and have lower cohesion, or that have an unreliable narrator, or something like that. That's a little bit more challenging, because you know that in their back pockets, these kids have the background knowledge that they need to be able to make inferences to a certain level. And now the job is to scaffold and support other parts of the challenge that is involved with reading. So I think those ideas of text selection, how crucial it is, the teaching of background knowledge to our kids in a coherent sequence way to be able to build knowledge for the future, but also by text selection.
I'm fascinated to know if you've got other stuff coming down the line in terms of research. Are there things you're working on at the moment?
Well, I'm just working on a couple of things at the moment. We've done a large survey of Australian primary teachers and about their reading practices and the beliefs that they hold about how students and children in their care develop reading proficiency, which is really interesting. Just in the first half of that's being published. The second one's just in the last polishing stages, but pointing to the fact that in Australia, as primary educators, we don't really have a common concept of how reading skill develops. We don't have a common knowledge base, and our practices are wildly different. And even within individuals, individual teachers can hold and use practices that are not only are they not complementary practices, but in actual fact, they work against each other to undermine some things that they're trying to develop. So it's just really interesting examination into the state of play of Australian primary teachers. And then after that, we've completed a quantitative study looking at what happens when we teach students a certain knowledge base and then ask them to read a variety of different texts and report back on the understanding that they have of those texts. And so really taking something that's these ideas that have been tested in more laboratory type sessions and then taking them into a real classroom with practicing teachers in a situation that's a little bit closer to the real life experience of schools and just see that holds up. So that the idea of this supporting aspect of background knowledge holds up in the rough and tumble of a proper classroom with kids over a couple of month period. So that'll be really exciting to release that soon enough.
Yeah, very much look forward to reading it as well.
Yeah, just intravenous injection of that that kind of research for me, straight into the vent. Because that's the pinnacle, isn't it? So yeah, really exciting. It's also great to see things in Ocra going from strength to strength. You know, the resources being developed. And I think teachers are even starting to write about their experiences of incorporating into their practices and things, which is exciting. It's fantastic to see how things are developing and how Australian teachers are being supported and being more research informed through the provision of high quality resources. It's fantastic. All that's left to do is say thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much, Reid.
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been a great chat and I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks for inviting me again.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.